Welcome to the Ryle Books Podcast, an archival space for the readings and conversations that we host in our bookshop and project space in Brussels. For this episode, we're delighted to share with you a recording of Rasia Wadud reading from her latest collection of poetry titled Mandible Wishbone Solvent, alongside a manuscript in progress, Any Want Rings the Circle. The reading took place at Ryle on the 12th of October 2024. Mandible Wishbone Solvent was published by the University of Chicago Press earlier this year. The poems and prose in the collection engage with ideas of migration, climate change, race, sexuality, and art, although not necessarily in that order. The book is punctuated with images of Asiya's own original artwork and offers an indirect meditation on the concepts of the drift and the isthmus, a passageway, a threshold, a deliverance. Rasia Wadud is a poet based in Brooklyn and the author of five collections of poetry, most recently Mandible Wishbone Solvent, No Knowledge is Complete Until It Passes Through My Body from 2021, A Filament in Gold Leaf and Syncope, which were both published in 2019, and Cross Light for a Young Bird from 2018. She has also been published in Interlude Docs, Poetry, Eflux Journal, Bomb Magazine, and in various other online and print publications. She teaches poetry at St. Anne's School in Brooklyn, New York, and Pacific Northwest College of Art. After the reading, we opened the floor to questions from the audience, and for technical reasons, the audio quality of the questions is not great, but we wanted to anyway include the conversation in the podcast. So we hope you can excuse the slight glitches in the audio towards the end. We hope you enjoy listening. So thank you all for being here, and thank you, Rasia.
Hi, it's so nice to be here, so nice to see all of you, and I'm so thankful that this reading could finally come into existence. And I hold the space in such high regard. I really feel like I've only been here in person one other time, but it has such like an outsized presence in my own mind. And I always have this fond feeling when I open the announcements and the newsletters back home in New York and see what's happening. And I feel like there's this kind of really good energy, and something important feels like it's going on here. So I feel really happy to be part of what's unfolding in the space. So thank you so much for having me, and it's so nice to see all of you today. I'm going to read some poems. For better or worse, from my latest collection, Mandible Wishbone Solvent. And then I'm going to read some pieces from this new collection, Any Want Rings the Circle. I think that's what it's called. I don't know just yet. I'm going to start with some pieces from Any Want Rings the Circle. Undoing. This is a seagull moving the gray cloud, velvet and obscene, obedient in its governance. Ask for help. Raise a peace flag. This is a resurgence moving the gray cloud, velvet and too much, obedient in its governance. Ask for help. Raise a peace flag. This is new, just now, moving the cloud, velvet and rolling, obedient in its governance. Ask for help. Raise a peace flag. So I asked for help. I raised a peace flag. The reply was yes. The distance was long, but possible. Move the day. Raise a flag. This piece is called Dissolution 2 Now Rests in Its Fragments. Finally, I splice ovum three ways, a field gently planted, clinical 14 and the others, fresh assault pearls, buried perceptively in the garden to mirror the womb, triplicate like family, syllabic, closed, coasting. I extract the vowels from the full word, I as in the last step of conjecture, as in exiting the mat frame, as in everything finished began with the eye of the needle. The wave crested began like eye. Dissolution too now rests in its fragments, adept at kaleidoscopic edges, elementary. Lone eye provides a stopgap while autumn passes in a long series of days. Umber eye, it gets older, brevity trapped in a window pane, refracts like creek water, like oval pond, like succumb. Viscous becomes perpetuation of eye, like broadbone and widening, like the eye of the needle, like the cataract that mirrors the fresh lake, like the thread that I and I saw as a filmic memory. Canon becomes what I have read, the thrill of the vertical edge. Temper the family, let it become line, accretion becomes mathematical, so that it barely becomes familiar. The line becomes patriline, blank box, like stopgap, as in naysay. So it's just like the cornea asks for the shield and its protectorate, for a false flag and then canary. Watch it like you have longed for it every day in waiting in game meat. This poem is called Number Four. And these titles are just really arbitrary, I realize, as I start to say them out loud. They're completely arbitrary. I don't even care about these titles. I just gave them titles because I felt like I should title them. It's easier for me to organize them if they have titles, but I'll probably end up changing them. Anyway, I guess they're all numbered at this point. This is number four. Poem three, number four. Everything we have made, halved in its own colloquial guardianship, the drained lake, the felled castle, the timbre of a lone voice not ever disturbed, the fist of new snow on its way to melting, well coagulating blood type O. All fallen sutures felled for unbearable reasons, unsystematic in its approach, steadfast in its sediment. To reach the kingdom before the only gate clenched, iron on iron and final, febrile in its will to be ocean, in its will to only want ocean, to say black but mean ocean. The embryo rests in a cavity, cleaned and called now womb. To go there is easy. You have been my want, all desire fostered among us. The supplier passes the iodine through me, clears the canal for anything. Every recoil is my own absent want, mine and not to be mine. I am a thimble of O blood cells, bluffing each time. To let other objects through me, it is possible for the tender wish to become a bone, to beckon to tend the animal and temper it. If I were my own arid island, I would know the word for it, would call it an island that would have me, though the room gives way to gray space, like the wish for any promise, prim and ill-used, a storage locker of unpaid bills and auctioned objects. If I were my own island, I would succumb to its measure. It lurches, how granular, its weighted scale becomes finality. Any blastocyst can live in deference, then die, extend any glib shadow, stretch the distance, then go be all the animated future then. Any body can read the threadbare clock, its second-hand proclamation succumbs to all 12 hours. Any want rings the circle, bears down with its one mouth, makes for want inside better want, made subterfuge, airtight container. It cannot lean less. It hangs in the plaza, crescendo, blue, O. Okay, I will read some poems from Mandible Wishbone Solvent. a friend of mine, when this book came out in February, she was like, Mandible Wishbone Solvent, did you just like put some words together and give your book a title? And actually I realized, I mean, maybe yes, but I felt somehow like kind of insulted. I was like, no, it was like a thoughtful moment in time in which I came up with this title. But Mandible Wishbone Solvent is, it's a poem that's in conversation with the American artist, but based in Finland for more than, I guess, like the last 30 30 plus years of his life. Howard Smith is his name, and he passed away actually in 2021, but lived for many years in Finland, which is where I spend a lot of time kind of back and forth between New York and Finland. And so this book is in large part in conversation with his work. He's a painter and a sculptor and a printmaker and a ceramicist and kind of a person of all hands, all work of hands. So this book is kind of for him and kind of thinking with him and thinking kind of just alongside him. And I wish I knew him when he was alive, but I do feel like somehow in like being close to his work in these last years, I've gotten this chance to kind of to be close to him and to get to know him in this other way. So many of these poems are for Howard Smith. I'll start off with the title piece. Mandible Wishbone Solvent, After Oracle Hero by Howard Smith. Roped in incremental ghost tens, future tens, clairvoyant tens, home tens. Blue slips beneath the exposed wing, tilt, then seam, then an angle spent all inside. The distance between thumb and thimble and fingerprint. Height exceeds, then brims, makes a solvent of it. What vaunted green excess enclosed in each skimmed year than the years, vanquished any fuchsia sky, the excess leaking forward, filmed aqua, filled aqua. Fastened by ulna, by increments of ten, fortunes sidled with, what have we when we give the mandible the fragments by tens? Tender tilt at 90 degrees to unearth blue slips beneath the exposed wing. Continents contain futures. You be here, tender tilt, remiss in skies, scant excess enclosed in a film that gives more than brimmed solvents to rest time. Many of these poems in this collection are also for the writer Etel Adnan, writer and painter Etel Adnan, if you're familiar with her work, who also passed away actually the same year as Howard Smith, but whose presence will always, I think, loom really large and wide and like ongoing. So there are many poems that are kind of in conversation also with Etel Adnan's work. So I didn't mark one, but I think I have an urge to read one now. Here's one. This one is called Shorn Shredded Red After Satellites 27, which is a painting of hers. Ochre starts, commence, catalyst, and even song enters. A flame lit, arched and yearn, gleam twofold. Weary, but not from this life. In time, flame begets pools of shorn Decembers. Limber months evade us. The flood begets burnished, catalyst and a hem, shredded red, quaked. Side gleam and slide trifold, mirroring the fresh lake whirring, mirroring the whirring shorn wave. 11 nocturnes, you Fibonacci, you catacomb. Ochre drifts, delivers the oysters. Reprisals in their opening mouths. Each expels what it nurtured, other ovals all along. Onion skin parchment, onion skin fermented, all cultivated alliums. Ocean drift delivers all umber, prize from the low tide, gathered up the dispersed objects, made them an offering. Onion skin and overture, oh, and orange peeled or singed parchment, O or starboard, port O or focal, O or my father's abject order, other O. Zero marks in absence, heart island overflow. Effluence onward and grace, O, and in other languages we'd say, how I missed you, while we place our hands together, other islands with an expendable O. I am solvent, deciduous, morning birds nesting in their half-finished homes. They enter through the open window, shelf for their only song. an operating theater slips and becomes diction or the first night of Ramadan, the cleaved even song, spectacular in its lament and its ordered lone song, operatic or oh. Open against the horizontal seams, equatorial, oh, open frontier or sieve, catchment or a swift return, pilgrimage or gilded. An operating theater slips and becomes diction or other futures, spectacular in its lament and order, only song, imperative that the song finishes, let the song finish then, sit inside the keening then, a single hymn for all of them. It begins the same way it ends, with the slipping of the long vowels and the shuddering of the others. A rowboat is a manual, as in hand over hand in what we sought, soft O like oblong and original or ordinance and horizon, other islands with an expendable O, the breath we breathe into it. All the hours it takes to articulate the O, our mouths are spent, days or hours of O. Now other steady streams build to music or grayscale, ocean or nautical O. The drum is taught. Since all the sounds ring in order, we call it a precision or song. Later, we place the metronome on the island. It disregards the place, keeps up its one dirge, lets it slip and finds its chorus. We place the instrument at the water's edge, but the pulse builds from the center. Salt keeps the water lifted, anathema or anthem or iron rich. We arrange the parchment, make of it an envelope, place inside it the soft O. Okay, I'm going to read a poem from my book, No Knowledge is Complete Until It Passes Through My Body. And I don't know what to say about it. Maybe there's nothing to say about it. I really love writing this poem. Sometimes I have these experiences where, maybe you know this experience if you write or create something, but I really loved being inside the experience of writing this poem and was so like reluctant to leave the experience, but finally I let it go. Which also is nice sometimes too, to just like let it go when it's time. A lot of the poems in that collection are kind of in conversation with Okwio Papasili, who's a Nigerian American. She's based in New York. She's a dancer and choreographer and writer. And many of the pieces in that collection are kind of in conversation with her work and thinking about this idea of like the choral we and what's possible in this kind of like we context that's not possible in the I. We are mired in matter until we are not. That's from Ralph Lemon. Attention as a form of ethics. Let's dissect what it means to mourn. Let's look at all the desiccant and what's left. Little exoskeleton bareback. How the straight line can become apparent. How the likeness is a labile breeze. Let's talk about shame. Let's talk about my face. Look at my kneecaps, my eyelids. Let's talk about hailing cabs. Let's look at my map. Let's look at how you molded me. I was a smattering of young kudzu. Look at the vagrant earth. Let's see what you see when you look, when you say, see? How the curvature becomes apparent. Each vertebra, the catacomb. Cat scratch and hay fever. Little motor at my shoulder. Let's round up the dead. The ones with the quick shuffle. The droopy soul. The double knot high tops. Let's look at the country. Let's call it territory as we're still deciding. The green heap, how it was electric. Let's look at the spectral to see how you molded me. I was a little sweetbriar. Let's be discreet when we claim this. Wouldn't want to tempt them. Myriad crystal landforms, each silent as the ocean. Now look at my topography. Now look at the mountain range. How can we ever do it justice? Do you know how we can do it justice? I have a keen aphasia. I call it code switch. It's kept me alive. How can I be anything? I'm shaped only in the dialectic. Everyone has their own pride. Lines move with the mute magic. Some animals are nocturnal. Some mother orcas mourn. Let's make an assumption. Let's make an assumption that the lake has a bottom. Let's make an assumption that everyone will mourn. Let's sack 100 greenbacks for the sake of acknowledging they mean something. What does it mean to have worth? Who would dream to drain a lake? I have spent my days staring into the eye of the Baltic. It's because I'm also a body of water. It's not that onerous. I have built a muscle memory. It's not that heavy. Let's talk about erasure. I mean, that's easy. Start with a word you don't like. Start with the people you didn't know. Start with a neighborhood rank. Start with any miasma dispersed. Let's talk about burden. Let's talk about burden for the weight it lends us. Let's talk about supplication. Let's talk about my palms uplift patience. Let's celebrate the substance, subsistence in amber rivulets of still life, constellations how you molded me, country how we became it, the longitude is a contested border, my longest muscle I name familiar. Let's reckon with the past, the logic, the middle passage, the hull, the tenderness, you were such demanding work. Let's demean what we don't like, because it's easier than a reckoning. Let's say the past means that it's finished, never acknowledged how it throbs immutably, forever finishing its punishing business. Let's talk about observance. Let's talk about pistol. Let's talk about ugly shapes. Let's talk about all the demands. Let's talk about mediocrity and spell it wrong. Let's talk about a quick conversation, one that skims the waters, a little stream down creek. Let's talk about my weariness. Let's get silky. Let my cat connect with me. Let the window stay a little open. Let my lid stay open. Don't call me labile. I'm just undulating. It's normal for anything to move just like any ocean. You didn't make a language. You made a few fissures. You made a little rucksack. You got down on your knees and call this patchwork pilgrimage. Let's remove the obvious from the image. What's left the residue? History is so residual. What's left the spectacle? What's left the spectral? A magnolia tree ransacked. The South is its own dispersal. My country loathes history. My country loathes its history. I'm not afraid of the dark now. I see its throbbing transmission. I see its blackness. I see its breath and fogginess. And then it comes into focus. Most knowledge is scant magic. Don't let me forget my language. Don't mistake umbrage for a coffer. Matte for high yellow, and to this gold. I have trouble with I. I am the valley. I am a hill. I am foxglove. I am gaping. I am both nightshade and morning. I am the lake. I have troubled I. I bore Bronson. I bore brownstone. I bore down on the bit left. Pillage and all that. With a quickness doubles back. Made an urgent isthmus. Let's talk about imbuing children with magnitude. Let's talk about age 9, about what we used to know, the magic, the marvel, in punto. You can't force justice, must move at the jaundiced pace of history, its gaping circularity. You must force justice, move against its low tide, all the things it jettisons, the politeness of collateral damage, must move from the jaundiced pace of history, its gaping circularity. Let's write something to quiet us, call it pernicious in the valley, aerate the soil for old time, palm oil for the propulsion. I have love from a great distance, from manifold mire treatments, little tree rings that barely reach, up the foxglove, down the cove. Let's talk about elegies and dirges. Let's talk about drifting, snowcaps, peat moss, and stillness. What is a quiet kingdom? What dim band of light? What is my birthright, my comportment? What is my breed love? What is a country without a crest, plaster instead of greatness, manifest in lieu of recompense? What is the creed that keeps us? Let's tumble towards my kind of south, barrel through the mid-Atlantic, hate on all its confinements, long for a few restrictions, cultivate the overtures. Let's make a meal and call it supper, butter the bread and call it finished, high tide for latitude, low tide for night swim. Let's dissect what it means to mourn. Let's look at all the desiccant and what's left, how the straight line becomes branded, how the likeness is a labile breeze. Let's talk about shame. Let's talk about my face. Look at my kneecaps. Let's talk about nail beds. Let's look at my map. Can't be used as evidence. By tomorrow we are drifting with our coffers, and by daybreak you will have had me molded. I think I will read one final poem. It's short. It's a small one. And thank you again. Thank you so much for coming and listening to poems. And I think I'll read one I don't usually read. Actually, maybe I'll read a bit of this essay. Drift against proximal distance from the center. In Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, drift the noun and drift the verb are defined in a handful of interlocking and overlapping terms. Each time a new meaning is defined, the word drift can attenuate or accumulate. The word comes alive through its accumulation of meanings. As the meanings pile up, the image of drift crystallizes. A series of images of drift appear, drift in the natural world, as ice flow could drift in our thoughts, the conversation drifted. Drift in the geopolitical context, a doomed vessel drifted at sea in the wake of no rescue. In the litany of meanings, there is also, quote, to move or float smoothly and effortlessly, to move along a line of least resistance, end quote. The resistance is what I return to, resistance as the possible antidote to drift, or maybe the antecedent to drift. Before an object or notion drifts, there is often an act of resisting it. Embedded in the act of drift can be the prior commitment or desire against drifting. Drift extends time on either end. Embedded in drift is the knowledge that it too once held the center and that it may not come back to hold it again. We succumb to drift. Or we can create the conditions in which we always know we will trouble the relationship between the center and the peripheral drift. We succumb to the relationship by design and desire. In drift's relative distance from its center, we acknowledge the rupture and coherence. Logic has frayed, the object has frayed. In training our eye to the center, drift brings the center's acuity into sharper relief. It brings it into focus. In naming what constitutes the center, it also names what is not the center. Drift also relates to the excess, the portion of excess, or defies expectation. It moves at a different pace than the center, and that altered pace defines it as that relative to all else that remains fastened. In this way, drift can become the non sequitur, the over there. Maybe at first we don't see it or didn't understand its historical relationship to the center, if there ever was one. In the movement of drift, there is a knowledge that that which is now considered drift was not once drift. It held closer to the center. In this way, drift is wrapped up with time. How long does anything need to move away from the center for it to constitute a drift? When do we finally name it drift, and what are the conditions relative to the center? Can each drift instead also become its own drift center in a constellation of drift centers? The center isn't fraying here, but maybe we are asked to think again about the firmness of the center, which could also be called the border, the plinth, the inside. We have constituted in what it would take to reimagine a new geography and a new landscape for it. Thank you again. Thanks so much for coming today. I thought that was a person first. I was like, okay, like, chill out. It's just some poems. So we can open it up for questions. I'm happy to answer any questions or what have you. Just, I'm very open to that.
I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the space of the page within your poems. Because a lot of them in Mental Richard Solvent, they're like, you really work quite variously with layout, with how the words actually move around on the page and how the text fragments. And I wondered if that happens in the writing process or in the editing and what it is.
Yeah, thanks for that question. I think, so my background before I came to poetry, my background is in city and regional planning and architecture. So I'm interested in, are you laughing? I'm interested in, in spatial geography and the space of the page kind of extends to that. I think often when I start writing a new piece, I have like one kind of like, one line or one kind of like a few lines that kind of orient the poem. And I often like what I do, since there's so much repetition and kind of this kind of like litany of language that kind of comes, I often, when I start writing, I write like one line and then I'll copy and paste it throughout the piece a few different times, knowing that I want to use it again and again, maybe not knowing yet like where or how it will appear. And so so as I start to write, I'm also always, I guess, thinking about the like the shape of the page and this, and the, also like the frame of like the white space on the page and what it can hold and what it, like what it lends to being able to read the poem in a few different ways. I think some poems do that, like more clearly than others within this new collection. But yeah, I'm interested. I mean, this book I think also is like, it's like in terms of the size, it's the biggest book that I have so far, and so there's a lot of white space, and yeah, I like what's possible to kind of to imagine like what can be contained within that space and kind of the space of the whole page, and kind of thinking architecturally or thinking spatially, thinking how the poems are also kind of traveling across each other and kind of through and with each other.
Yeah, sort of, because there's the essay in the end of the book about the isthmus, which is then, yeah, this kind of land gap somehow. Could be like a bridge, but could also be another way of two distinct pieces of land kind of connecting. And a bit like, yeah, with how the words are maybe have a certain distance to it. I don't know. I felt that like a lot through the writing itself also somehow, as if you're like coming to a riverbed, for instance, and you see the other side of the river. And even though probably in terms of the trees that are on the other side, they may be the same as on your side, but they sort of look different. And I had that like with a lot of the lines in the poem somehow, that they just look different, even though it's not like they're, you don't really use neologisms or something, like new made-up words. But yeah, I don't know, maybe I was wondering a little bit about the sort of newness of language somehow, which poetry can do, but I felt that quite prominent.
Yeah, so during the daytime, I teach children. I teach like 5, 6, 7, the school where I teach goes from age 3 to 18. And so I teach poetry to children starting when they're 5. And when they're 5, like they're learning to write. Some of them are like quite facile and like really writing, but most of them need a scribe. And so I am their poet scribe. I come to poetry class once a week with every class and have my notebook. We read a poem together. We discuss the poem together. And then I present a prompt to the kids related somehow about the poem that we've just read. And this will relate back to what you were just asking. I'm just trying to find out how. So, okay, so I have this notebook, I have all their poems, and so much of my day with children is like thinking a lot about how to say something again and again and again until I'm understood to all of the kids in the room without ever like really getting angry or frustrated or annoyed, just kind of like using it as reframe it as like a chance to like find a new way to say it, or like a way that like will connect with like someone who still feels confused or like uninterested or like not drawn to what we're doing. And so I think in this, like, I've been teaching at the school now for not quite 10 years, but like coming to 10 years. I think in that time, my writing has really changed, and I really have thought about repetition in brand new ways and kind of thinking about like, what does it mean to like keep saying the same thing again and again, but like at maybe like at an angle or like at like a quarter turn or kind of like slight turn, like being able to maybe like see those trees on the other side, but seeing them slightly differently, like from the bank. So I think that has really found its way into my own work. And I mean, just in general, working with children always finds its way into my work because they have so many questions that I would never, ever, ever dream. Like I have no way of accessing to even think to ask at all. I really love their questions and their demands also. It's like, you know, like they're writing and they're like, what's a word that starts with O that means to move like a wave and it's two syllables? And I'm like, can you be a little more flexible? Like if you can be more flexible, I can help you find the word that you're looking for. Like, can you be flexible? And sometimes they're like, yeah, I can be flexible. I'm like, okay, so labile, undulating, wave-like, lateral. I'm like, okay, I have it. Thank you. But like sometimes they're like, no, I am not flexible. So then like that's also fun too. So then it's like, okay, a two-syllable word that starts with an O that means to move like a wave. And I love that they also just assume that like that word exists. Like they're like, there must be a word that does that, like meets all those needs, which I love. And I'm just like, like I don't know what word that is. And sometimes I'm just like, I don't know. And they're so disappointed. They're like, I really don't know, but I'll try my best to think about it. But I love those questions from them. And they come like every day. It's like, you know, all these like really specific parameters of words they're looking for to suit their own poems. So, yeah.
I was wondering about the peaceful position and then the last poem you read and then the one with the letter O. I thought I love those poems, like almost like a physical entry into a certain rhythm or dance, or just facing in a direction that like shifting just a little bit every time. And I was wondering about the physicality of that rhythm while you're writing, like you feel it when you read it.
Yeah, this poem that has all the O's in it is, so that poem definitely was, I was thinking about, first of all, this question that this kid really did ask, like, what does it mean? What's a word, this O, like this O word? But this poem, I wrote it at the very start of a COVID lockdown in New York. So this was like March 2020. I had COVID myself then as well and got quite sick. And so I was really thinking about this pleasure and this pleasure of breathing, this like pleasure of like taking in a good breath. And so there is something actually that does feel quite physical in, I think, writing that poem, but also reading that poem and kind of being in the space of that poem. Somehow, I think with certain pieces, and maybe others feel the same way, I think certain pieces kind of call for this kind of embodiment in different ways than other pieces do, but that poem definitely is one of them. And then you mentioned another poem too. Was it The Long One? The Long One. Yeah. 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 The repetition in that one. I don't know what to say so much about that piece, but it's a bit older. It's from 2018 and I, wrote it kind of thing. I mean, it was like, it has many kind of like many worlds, I guess. I was thinking kind of inside of writing that piece, but I think something in the length of that piece also kind of invites this rhythm to it. I think a lot of, you know, a lot of prayers have maybe a similar repetition to them. And so there is this kind of quality of embodying a poem in the same way that maybe like I prayed when I was a child, like when I was like taught certain prayers. I think there's something kind of, and I loved, even though I didn't necessarily feel so much an attachment when I was young to like the prayers, the work of the prayers themselves, I did love the language of the prayers and that kind of embodiment of like repetition of prayers. And so I think that also finds its way into the work.
I was wondering about collaborative processes you entered into through writing. It's not really a question. I have more like a curiosity. How does that happen? And is it like, because it's usually artists, visual artists as well. Mm-hmm. Is it much more, has to do with like the person's call over, or is it more related to specific artworks? Like, how does the writing come in and out?
Yeah, So there are a few different kind of collaborative processes that I have like found myself in these past few years. The one that's kind of ongoing and kind of I hope will just continue for like for a long time is this collaboration with Okwio Pakwasili, who maybe there's a copy of that book. Okay, yeah, it's called A Filament in Gold Leaf, I think. Day Pulls Down the Sky, A Filament in Gold Leaf. Yes, that's what it's called. And so she, the way that worked is that, so she's a choreographer and a dancer and a writer. She's someone, it's like someone who whose work I've been following for many years before we started a collaboration. And with that particular book, she wrote the songs first. So it's a collection of, it's like liner notes for these, for this album called Day Pulls Down the Sky. And then she sent me the songs, and I listened to the songs over the course of some weeks, and then wrote the poems kind of quickly. It's kind of like a quick book in a way, and then wrote the poems kind of in response to those songs. But our collaboration has taken many forms over the years. Like I think after we worked on that book, I was a performer in a piece of hers right at the start of the pandemic that was like that had to do with this kind of slow walk of like 40 dancers and other performers kind of moving across a space from like maybe here to the garage door, taking about 6 hours to get across that space and back across, like for, you know, like over the course of an evening. So really this kind of like slow walking and walking together and kind of uttering things like in this kind of choral quality. And so the collaborations just kind of continue and kind of are ongoing with Okwi anyway. With some of these other pieces that are here, the Atel Adnan, I wrote those pieces as a commission for the Guggenheim. After she passed away, she had a show called... I can't remember right now. I really want to remember, though, because it had a really beautiful title. Maybe it's here. I can't remember. It had something to do with light, which is like, okay, doesn't really matter. Anyway, but I wrote those pieces kind of, like I wrote them as like for a special occasion for the closing of that show. And then for all the Howard Smith pieces, yeah, those have like a different distance. I think I'm always interested in like the different distances that collaborations can take. Like with Okwi, it's like at this point, she's a friend. Like when we first started collaborating, she was just someone who I admired and who every time would do something in New York, I would like buy tickets for every single day and just like go to every production that she does until finally she's like, do we know each other? I'm like, I hope, I think. And we finally started working together. But yeah, I don't know. I think, yeah, I'm interested in like the distance of each one of these collaborations. They all kind of take different shapes and different forms, and I feel open always to writing in conversation. I always have this feeling that I really wouldn't have anything to say at all, like really not that much to say unless it's like responding to someone else's work. Maybe that's not true, but that's definitely the feeling that I have anyway. So yeah, I'm interested in that kind of writing, something that feels like it's not happening alone, that kind of peels back this kind of like we that I was talking about and makes it very visible. What did you say?
Nice measure.
Thank you.
That's exactly what it was called. Nice measure. That was the show.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, that's what it was. I love that. I love that name. And there are so many pieces, like so many gorgeous pieces. This one piece that I read, the Satellites 27, it's the name of multiple paintings of Atel Adnan, Satellites 27. She keeps giving pieces the same name, which has been kind of instructive somehow to me. Don't agree. No. Bad idea.
Maybe I have one more question. I don't know if there's any other questions in the room, but otherwise I'll jump in. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the relation between like embodiment and absence, because I feel like it's maybe a bit of a large question, but I feel like there's something, like you deal, all, like the poems in in the book are really, there's something extremely like vibrant and like vital about them. Like there is this sense of a kind of physicality in the work. And then I think somehow there's also a lot of recurring things that come back that are around some form of disappearance or gap or, and there's even like the quote in the beginning of the book is about the carbon copy paper,
right,
and the black sheet on the middle,
yes,
where the lines are imprinted on the black sheet, but they're invisible, but they're there.
Maybe I'll read that, yeah. Okay, so this is an excerpt from Teju Cole. If you are familiar with his work, he's a, well, it doesn't really matter. Anyway, this is, it's from Black Paper, his most recent, or maybe like last, like second to most recent work. And this is what it says. When you use the carbon paper correctly, you ended up with two copies of the same document. The top white sheet bore original hand ink writing. The bottom white sheet was the mimic of every stroke and dot. What I had not noted at the time was that on the black paper, there was a third copy of whatever had been written. The black paper was rigid and marked with all the original handwriting, black on black, full of meaning, but shaped by absence. The black paper was the ghostly record, black on black, secretly sensible. So I really love that. I love the secretly sensible. I know this might sound kind of silly, but at the time when I chose this epigraph for the book, I felt much closer to these poems than I do now, just because of the distance of time of having written them then, and now here they are, 1 year later or something. But in my mind, it was like I had much more clarity about like what it was that resonated. I still know that it deeply resonates, and I do understand this like this absence and embodiment, and this kind of tension between them. I think this book also, it's written most of it like during the pandemic, like during the deep pandemic times. And so I think, I think a lot of these pieces are wrestling with that as well, like directly or indirectly. Yeah, I want to think about that question. I feel like it's a question I want to think about, but I don't really have like more of an answer right now. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Essia, for your very generous reading and answering the questions. And thanks, Erin, for also coming today.
Thank you. Yes, thank you. Thanks so much. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Ryle Books podcast. This episode was edited by Roz Del Olmo. You can find more of our past and upcoming events on our website, www.ryle.space.